It's a great pleasure to welcome you to a lecture in the rotunda on the subject of the Eisenhower presidency and McCarthyism. The subject of interest to the Miller Center of Public Affairs is, as you know, the study of the presidency. It would be difficult to imagine a more complex and troublesome, difficult problem with which any administration has had to deal than the problem of McCarthyism. It was a subject that those who didn't live actively at the present in the educational or political arena at that time can hardly understand in terms of its intensity and degree of feeling. My exposure to it was very limited, but and I won't belabor that tiny little experience, only to say that once in my life have I left a building with a cordon of police helping me out of the building, and that's when in a discussion with Senator McCarthy's campaign manager, in which my subject was the limits and possibilities of collective security, it became necessary to call on the police to take us out of the building. That example only to show how enormously inflammatory the issues were at that time and how deeply and passionately many felt. Barbara Tuchman, in introducing Mr. Ewald's volume, writes, "The era of shame vividly recreated for us by an insider in Eisenhower's White House who knew the participants and observed the events at close quarters. Read it and remember." Mr. Ewald has contributed to the Eisenhower Portrait volume published by the Miller Center. He was, as Barbara Tuchman says, an insider in the White House, an assistant to Secretary of the Interior Fred Seaton. He wrote a biography that was widely reviewed and highly praised by the reviewers, by Arthur Burns, who called it a literary masterpiece on the Eisenhower presidency. He collaborated with President Eisenhower on President Eisenhower's two volumes, Mandate for Change and Waging Peace, which represented Mr. Ewald's collaboration with the president at Gettysburg. He is currently an executive of the IBM Corporation and is well known for his skill and ability as an even-handed interpreter of public affairs, a very wise scholar in his own right before entering the White House in the field of literature, having taught in the English department at Harvard University. And we feel especially pleased that he would return to the Miller Center to discuss his new book, Who Killed Joe McCarthy? An account of the struggle that went on in the Eisenhower administration in connection with the movement of McCarthyism. It's a pleasure to welcome William Bragg Ewald, Jr. to the Dome Room of the Rotunda.
Believe me, I enjoyed every word, Ken, that very, very glowing and I think undeserved introduction, but I'm honored and flattered by it. And let me say that as an admirer of Ken Thompson and the Miller Center and what they've been doing there, it's a real pleasure for me and for my wife Mary to come back again, have an opportunity to visit the university and to speak with you today. I'm not a Virginian, And I apologized. I did the next best thing. I married a Virginian, and my wife grew up here in the state and is really loved it and felt very close to it. And so many of my relatives, many friends, all my children and my wife are Virginians, and I feel I'm, in a sense, maybe Virginian by adoption. I also had the honor later, after we were married, of working for a president, as Ken Thompson has said, who, someone once asked me, did Dwight Eisenhower have any role models? And I answered immediately, he had two role models, and they were both Virginians. One was George Washington, and one was Robert E. Lee. And there was absolutely no qualification in his admiration for both of them. I've always felt modeled himself and tried to follow the example of George Washington personally. And he loved Robert E. Lee. Remember one time he was talking about painting, he liked to paint, and he said he wanted to do a portrait of Robert E. Lee, but he was very, Eisenhower was very, very modest about his painting. He said the only trouble was I could never get the whiskers right. So he never finished the portrait. Now, it's an honor to speak here in this hallowed Jeffersonian hall on a diabolical subject. I don't know whether you saw the cover of the book, but it shows Senator McCarthy almost like a man burning in hell flames. You feel that if you had to look at American history and look at two figures who really exemplified two poles of, on the one side, the freedom of the mind, and on the other side, obscurantism and an attempt to curtail and thwart intellectual exploration. You couldn't think of two figures who fill those roles better than, on the one hand, Thomas Jefferson, and on the other hand, Joseph McCarthy. I would say rightly or wrongly, I think these conceptions are in the public mind. So I would say that in talking about who killed Joe McCarthy, and then the career of McCarthy, his anti-communist crusade, that was the root struggle. And Elmer Davis pointed out in the Phi Beta Kappa lecture at Harvard in June of 1953, it was a struggle over man's right to free inquiry and to the freedom of the mind against people who wanted to attempt to thwart that in some respects. That's not the struggle I really want to talk about here today, however. The struggle I've been concerned with, and I was concerned with in the book, is the more immediate, grainy, grimy, dirty political battle that went on day by day between a United States senator from Wisconsin, elected by an overwhelming majority with a great popular following in his own state, on the one hand, and the Republican administration, an administration which shared the same political banner as McCarthy, but that was headed by a vastly different man, Dwight Eisenhower. And that struggle, that clash, is the clash really that in the end destroyed McCarthy. And when we say who killed Joe McCarthy, let me tell you, I'm not talking about who poisoned him. I had somebody call up and say, I know who poisoned Joe McCarthy. It's the same people who poisoned Robert Taft. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the political death of McCarthy and his political demise. As you probably know, he had a very, very substantial public following. He had it for many years, like 4.5 years. And yet, at the end of that 4.5 year period, at the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings, McCarthy was really a dead duck politically. Now, I will say that that is a controversial subject. It's controversial even to this present day. As you read various reviews of the book, you'll gather this, because people do not agree. And for example, George Will finds my argument very persuasive, and he likes it, and other people don't. Barbara Tuchman likes it, and I think this is one of the few things George Will and Barbara Tuchman have ever agreed on. Nonetheless, you will find a continuing controversy over this particular subject. So I say, read the evidence and take your pick, and best of all, read the book, Simon & Schuster, 1795. And you can get it cheaper if you remember the Book of the Month Club, because it's the Book of the Month Club selection. Now, this is not just in a way a historical subject. At the present moment, I would say that we've got to look at this controversy between Eisenhower and McCarthy in a larger context, and that is the context of the reexamination of the Eisenhower presidency. And I find that reexamination highly significant today. If you listen to Governor Cuomo in his keynote speech at the Democratic Convention, and if you listen to Ronald Reagan in his speech to the convention, I think you notice something that's rather unusual. You noticed in both parties a searching and a drive of some sort to find heroes for the party. And Governor Cuomo, quite obviously, had his heroes, and the key hero, and it ran all through his speeches, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He thinks of the Democratic Party in terms of Franklin D. Roosevelt's example. He wants the Democratic Party to look back to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt is a hero. Reagan, in contrast, did a very unusual thing. Reagan forgot the Republican heroes, forget Nixon, forget Herbert Hoover, forget Calvin Coolidge, forget Warren G. Harding. And he reaches over in the Democratic Party and pulls the heroes he wants into the Republican Party: Harry Truman, Jack Kennedy, and Hubert Humphrey. Now, that's a rather neat political trick, but what I'm saying is that at the moment, I think in both parties, and particularly in the Republican Party, there is a search for models out of the past who can guide the party in the future. And I would say that the example of Dwight Eisenhower is an example that the Republican Party today ought to be taking a good look at. Eisenhower is a Republican centrist. He hated the labels liberal and conservative. He said what you try to do is go down the middle and you try to do what makes sense. Sometimes you'll end up doing a conservative thing. Sometimes you do a liberal thing. But use the sense the good Lord gave you and go down the middle. And, of course, he commanded an enormous following in that center mainstream, not only the Republican Party, but of the United States. He reached over into the Democratic Party and they came in droves. Now, the perception of Eisenhower's presidency, I think, will matter in the future of the Republican Party. And nothing, to many people, is more central to the perception of Eisenhower's presidency than how he dealt with McCarthy. Did he succeed? Did he fail? Did he waffle? Was he scared to death of McCarthy? Was he a mastermind behind the scenes trying to kill off McCarthy? What was his view? How effective was he? And I think until we can try to come to grips with that, I think the image of Eisenhower will continue to carry some kind of a cloud over it, and people will not really understand the nature of the man and the nature of his contribution. That's really the purpose. That's why I wrote the book, just try to straighten out that particular feature of the Eisenhower performance. And I will say it's not a simple task. There's not a pat answer, and it's not an either-or thing. It's a difficult thing to sort out. Now, let me ask for a show of hands, how many people remember Joe McCarthy and remember the era and remember having lived through it and remember watching the debates? Let's see, I guess like a police count of a crowd, I'd say maybe it's 50-50. And a lot of people don't remember. So let me just reel off the what we're talking about now. McCarthy flies out, United States Senator, in February 9th, 1950, to Wheeling, West Virginia, to make a routine political speech. And he gets up and he gets out of the car. He's met by the welcoming committee, and he says, "Gentlemen, I've got two speeches in my pocket." on two different subjects, written by two different staff groups. One of them is on housing. One of them is on communists in government. Which one do you think I should give? And the welcoming committee says, why don't you do the one on communists in government? So McCarthy said, that has a little more sex appeal. So McCarthy says, okay. He gets up that night and he pulls out of his pocket a speech, and he makes a speech in which he says, I have here in my hand a list of 205 members of the Communist Party who today are in high offices in the State Department making high U.S. policy, and they are known to the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson. From there on, McCarthy is on page one. He is a leader in the anti-communist movement. People follow him. They want to find out what he knows, whom he can identify, and so on. He goes on from there. In the course of the following months, he calls General George C. Marshall, United States Army Chief of Staff during World War II, a man who has served the communist conspiracy, a traitor to the country. And he goes after the State Department, investigates the Voice of America, investigates a lot of people. In the end, he ends up investigating the United States Army, not people in uniform, but the civilian bureaucrats in the Department of the Army, in the employ of the Army. And he's on to something. He thinks there are a lot of communists in one of their installations, and he is carrying forward this investigation. Meanwhile, on his staff, he has a young man named G. David Shine, who's a junior member on his staff. And G. David Shine has registered for the draft, and his draft board acts, puts him in 1A, says, you're going into the Army, and they put him in the Army. So these two things going along concurrently, McCarthy's investigation, Shine's being drafted into the Army, lead to the confrontation, a series of charges and countercharges. The Army charges that McCarthy is seeking special favors in the Army for Private Shine. Get him out of KP on Sunday. Give him the weekends off. Give him special privileges at night, that kind of thing. And also, that's one thing, in that he's abusing his power, McCarthy and his followers, his chief counsel, Roy Cohn. On the other side, the Army comes back with its, I'm sorry, McCarthy comes back with his countercharge against the Army. He says, look, you've got this young man in the Army as a private. You're using him as a hostage. You're twisting his arm. You're trying to make life tough for him as a threat to get me to carry, to cut off my investigation of the Army. Okay, they make these charges and countercharges public. The Senate committee has to investigate them. And between April of 1954 and June of 1954, these hearings go on to air these particular grievances, charges and countercharges. Now, with those hearings, when they were over, by the time they had ended, they had killed McCarthy. I walked into the White House at 8 o'clock in the morning on July 26, 1954. This was about a month and a half after the hearings had ended. And from that date on, I can tell you, we didn't spend 1 minute or 1 hour or 1 day worrying about Joe McCarthy or about what he thought, about what his influence was, about his political power, about anything. He was dead, dead, dead. And I remind you that in those months, we were going through a congressional election in which he promised the issue of communists in government would be the key issue. People didn't want him to speak for them. He was out of it, and he remained out of it, and he walked around like a man of living death for several more years, finally died in 1957. Okay. In December of 54, I remind you, the United States Senate voted a censure motion against McCarthy, very rare action by the Senate. And that put the final nail in his coffin. But believe me, they would not have voted that censure action
had he not been politically prostrate at the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings. Okay, as you can imagine, there have been millions of words written about this, many books. Why do another one? What I was trying to do is really to straighten out and fill out the factual record and to answer that question. What was it exactly that brought McCarthy down, that really destroyed him? Because to this time, I have never seen a really satisfactory answer. People just get the idea he just kind of, the American people were tired of him, or that he just kind of came to an end. And during McCarthy's life, he really sowed confusion and hysteria and distortion and misunderstanding, misinformation. And believe me, to this day, that question is still clouded with the same kinds of things. Now, it's great to say you want to get new information and you want to add to the record. How do you do this when the record's been done to death? Well, to quote McCarthy himself, let me say, I have here in my hand a three-page transcript, single-spaced, of a telephone call. I've got thousands of these. This thing was a phone call between Secretary of the Army Robert Stevens and Struve Hensel, who was the general counsel for the Department of Defense. And they're discussing what they ought to be doing about McCarthy. This cache of records of new documents was locked up during the Army-McCarthy hearings by order of President Eisenhower. They were documents of various sorts. There were memoranda of conferences. There were diary kinds of journal entries. And above all, there were these memoranda of telephone conversations. Now, the Secretary of the Army and other people in the Pentagon had the practice. They didn't tape conversations the way Nixon did, or the way Charles Zwick did, or other people have, modern technology. What you have, if you're the Secretary of the Army, you have a guy sitting out there around the corner at a little desk, and he's got a phone cradled on his shoulder. And when you pick up the phone to take an incoming call, he picks up the phone and listens in without telling the incoming caller. And he's a very fast Greg shorthand operator, and he takes it all down and fills these books with it. And these conversations, verbatim conversations in the Pentagon, went on and on and on for months and months and months. And at the climax of the hearings, they were locked up. They never saw the light of day. McCarthy would have loved to have got his hands on them. He never did. They remained in the possession of the executive branch, and have there remained until this book came out. And there they are in the book for the first time, published. Now, they are now public documents. But the value of those documents is to permit someone for the first time to reconstruct a narrative that goes along day by day, minute by minute, through this whole period of months where you have these controversies going on, and you can see who was doing what and who was taking what action and how people were responding to one another. So that's one source of new information. The second source is interviews with people who really were behind the closed doors, where they were really figuring out what to do about McCarthy. Sherman Adams, Eisenhower's chief of staff, one of them. Jim Haggerty, I interviewed Jim before he died. I have access to Jim's diary, and I've used that. Fred Seaton, Ken Thompson mentioned that I worked for Fred Seaton when Fred was in the Department of the Interior, but I had known him when we were both on the White House staff, and Fred was the White House man in the Pentagon, the agent of Eisenhower and Adams, the agent. Believe me, there were no other agent. And he was the man who gathered all these papers together and took them with him, kept them with him all through Washington, and at the end of his career in Washington, took them with him to his home out in Hastings, Nebraska, where they remained until really I got hold of them. There are plenty of big
Joe Welch, who was the Army Special Counsel, died very soon after the hearings, but his number two man, Jim St. Clair, couldn't have been more helpful on recalling things that they did and trying to straighten out the record. And along with these major figures, Struve Hensel, another one, every major figure on the administration side who's today alive I've talked to and have had unqualified, wholehearted recollections and help from, plus a lot of minor characters, like the man who actually picked up these papers and carried them across the White House, or like the man who carried around the briefcase for Joe Welch and really followed him like a shadow, night and day, through the whole of the hearings. Nobody even knows who he was. Anyway, he talked to me at great length. So I like to think that the result is a book that, my view, reads like a novel and goes behind the scenes. The upshot of the book is, I believe, that it disproves the easy, simple, pat myths about who killed Joe McCarthy, such as McCarthy was killed by booze. Now, no question, McCarthy drank. He drank like a fish. He'd drink in the morning, he'd drink for breakfast, he'd drink after breakfast, he'd drink before he went to work, he'd drink on the job, he'd drink at lunch, he'd drink in the afternoon, he drank in the evening, and he sometimes could drink all night with drinking buddies who slept, I guess, during the day while he was working. He was a heavy drinker, but booze, to my mind, had nothing whatsoever to do with it. If he had never touched a drop, I think he would have been the same Joe McCarthy. He would have had the same political problem with him as you had. Second villain who killed Joe McCarthy, Roy Cohn killed him. You've probably heard this. Here was this sharp young lawyer leading this kind of bumbling, noisy senator around by the nose, getting him into a lot of trouble. You talk to friends of McCarthy today, they hate Roy Cohn. Some of them do, not all of them. Roy Cohn himself still admires McCarthy, but believe me, a lot of people tried to put the blame. Well, it wasn't really Joe, it was Roy. I don't believe that. I don't believe Roy Cohn killed Joe McCarthy, and I do not see Roy Cohn as the problem either. Joe McCarthy was a problem. Those of you who remember Edward R. Murrow's famous telecast against McCarthy, see it now on prime time. Early in 1954, March of 1954, a lot of people say Edward R. Murrow killed McCarthy with that single telecast. Other people say it was Herb Bloch of the Washington Post who killed him with his cartoons. I don't believe that either, although Murrow had a part in it. Herb Bloch hacked away at McCarthy day after day, but basically they were adjuncts to something that I think was more central and farther down. Joe Welch, the Boston lawyer, pixie-ish, gentle, dapper, shrewd, with an instinct for the jugular. No doubt, during the hearings, he became a folk figure, beloved folk figure, by millions of people on television. And people will tell you today, Joe Welch came, and after everybody else had failed, he came to Washington, and he killed McCarthy. I don't believe that either, because Joe Welch came in very late. He did a very special job. It was a crucial job. It was a key job. It was a very important job in the destruction of McCarthy, but he didn't do it all by himself, single-handedly. I'll give you one fact. Before Joe Welch ever came into Washington, in the month preceding, McCarthy's public opinion rating dropped from 46% approval to 36% approval. For the first time, a significant downward drop. Joe Welch he hadn't even been selected then. Beautiful and chic and knowledgeable friend of ours said, I know who killed Joe McCarthy. It was Bob and Ray. That's one I'd never heard before. They said he made fun of him. Well, I don't think Bob and Ray killed him either. Now, the simple, pat explanations about, I've left out one name, Dwight Eisenhower. What role did he have? There are two simple, pat explanations to the Eisenhower role. A, Eisenhower didn't do anything. He was scared to death of McCarthy. He tried to stay away from him. He didn't want to get involved. He let other people take the heat. He let other people suffer. And he got as far away as he could. That's one answer. That's wrong. The second answer, and this is a more recent answer, and it started to come in as people have looked at the Eisenhower role and looked at some of the evidence, swings all the way over to the other side. And it is Dwight Eisenhower single-handedly brought him down. And he brought him down by a process of maneuvering behind the scenes, pulling the strings. He knew everything that went on day by day. Sat there in the Oval Office, didn't tell anybody, worked through his agents, pulled these wires, and controlled everything. And his, with a single-minded purpose, he brought McCarthy down all by himself. And this is the view. It really started a long time ago. This is the conception of Eisenhower, the sneak. That is, the man who really is so clever and diabolic and Machiavellian in his cleverness that he can kill people and still seem to rise above it out there with his nice grin and seem not to be hurting anybody. I find that explanation wrong also. I'll tell you one reason I find it wrong. If you look at that spring of 1954, Eisenhower wasn't sitting there in the White House worrying about McCarthy all the time. In fact, I don't think Eisenhower worried about McCarthy even as much as 50% of his time, or 40%. You know what he was worrying about in the spring of 1954? Among other things, he was worrying about whether we should go into Vietnam. And believe me, he thought that was a far more agonizing decision. It was a far more intricate decision. He had to worry with the French and with the British and with the Vietnamese and with the American people and so on, trying to sort his way out through that whole business. The spring of 1954 was also the spring when the Supreme Court announced its Brown versus Board of Education decision on civil rights. It was also the spring in which Eisenhower spent many, many weeks on something people have now forgotten called the Bricker Amendment, which would have curtailed the powers of the presidency, powers of the president to make treaties. He had a lot on his plate, including the biggest legislative program he ever introduced to the Congress. So to say that he was sitting there worrying single-mindedly about McCarthy, I find an exaggeration. Therefore, what I would say is that what I've tried to do is tell the story, lay out the history, and it's almost like saying what happened in War and Peace. And somebody comes back at you and says, well, look, you don't have to read that book. I'll tell you. Napoleon lost. Now, if you want to, you can say McCarthy was defeated, or you can say so-and-so did it, but the question is not did he do it, but how did he do it, and what was going on, and what were the shortcomings? And I find this thing it's like a battlefield. It's like some of the scenes in Henry IV, Part 1, or Henry V, where you see a skirmish over here, and then the scene changes, you get a skirmish over there, and you get a skirmish over here, and the people are engaged in conflict in the middle of the night. They don't know what the other people are doing on the battlefield, and it's that kind of an action, a rolling action, that you have all through these months. It's absolutely fascinating, and that at the end results in McCarthy's death. And in that action, Dwight Eisenhower is a central figure. No question about it. But believe me, he didn't do everything perfectly. He made a lot of mistakes. There were a lot of things he didn't know about, a lot of things he didn't control, and there's a lot of sheer dumb luck in the whole episode. So I think that's where I find history far more fascinating than spinning theories. And that's what I've tried to do. You have a great cast of characters, Most people don't even think of Thomas E. Dewey, for example, who was ran against Truman in 48 and was a big Eisenhower backer. People don't even know he had a part in this whole thing. Well, he did have a part. He was way behind the scenes. He was the man who really, as much as anybody, helped pick Joe Welch and put him in there. Nobody knew that. Secondly, Morris Ernst, the great civil libertarian, the lawyer who successfully defended the publication and sending through the mails of James Joyce's Ulysses in 1933. Morris Ernst had a part in this, and it's a very fascinating part because Morris Ernst managed to penetrate the McCarthy organization, and he was supplying information to the Army side. Nobody knew about that. And there are dozens of other people who have an action in this. I had a very nice letter, as a matter of fact, a couple of days ago from Senator Stuart Symington, who was a Democrat on the McCarthy Committee and, in a sense, a kind of an enemy, the Republicans. And he said he'd read the book and he admired it very much and liked it. And I thought that was a very gracious thing for him to say because obviously there were some political tensions in there and McCarthy was very rough on Symington, and the administration people, to a certain extent, were rough on Symington, but he's a gentleman. So I'd say what I've tried to do is establish a piece of history. I would say that out of this all, before I give you a chance to ask some questions, you get a great overriding lesson, I think, that remains with us and that we ought to remember, and that is, what do you do about a demagogue, about a man who is standing up and exaggerating or distorting or falsifying or whatever for some kind of political purpose and who has a following? How do you get rid of him? And we've had demagogues. We're going to have demagogues as long as you can imagine. We've had them from the time of Alcibiades. He's in Thucydides. He's in Plutarch. We've had Hitler in our own time. We had McCarthy. We've had Huey Long. We've had a lot of them, and we're going to have them some more. And it seems to me that it's not a bad idea to look at some case studies. And there are certain ways in which you cannot bring down a demagogue. I'd say that the main thing you need is what Thomas Jefferson said we needed. You need eternal vigilance. People have to have their eyes open. They have to be aware. They have to be paying attention. They have to be adding up. When a man says 2 and 2 equal 5, they have to do their addition themselves and cut him off. That's one thing. Eternal vigilance. Without that, you can't do anything. But the other thing you need, and I think this is the thing that you really get out of this book and this episode and the Eisenhower conduct, you need some very hard-headed, practical, realistic sense about what options are open to you. Now, people will say, why didn't Eisenhower, within 5 minutes after he got into office, get rid of McCarthy? One woman wrote in to the president and said, Mr. President, I think you ought to fire McCarthy. You can't fire a senator. It's hard enough to get a censure vote. If you want to recall, you have all kinds of devices. The people of Wisconsin could have voted for his opponent, but they didn't. The president has no power whatsoever to fire a senator. Okay, I understand that. What Eisenhower could have done, he could have got up, I would have written him a speech, and he could have got up and delivered that speech, and in 5 minutes it would have floored McCarthy. Well, let me tell you, Eisenhower had around him excellent speech writers. He had speech drafts handed to him. These people knew what they were doing. They were, believe me, they were as red in the face about McCarthy as they could get. They were furious. They thought a speech would do it. And if a speech could have done it, he would have done it. Into the bargain, he'd had not only these aides around who were advising him to make this speech. He had probably the most trusted advisor in the world, the man he admired, whose judgment, bottom judgment, integrity, honesty, sense, he admired, I think, probably as much as anybody else and possibly more. That was his brother Milton. Now, you look at Milton Eisenhower's career. Milton Eisenhower had been a government bureaucrat. He'd been in the Agriculture Department. He'd been in the State Department. He'd come in. He'd worked for President Roosevelt on special missions during the war. He was in the OWI with Elmer Davis. For heaven's sakes, Milton Eisenhower was the kind of guy McCarthy would have loved to hate. And in fact, McCarthy denounced Milton Eisenhower on public broadcasts in Wisconsin as a nefarious influence on the administration. Milton would sit there in the Oval Office with his brother Ike, and he'd say, Ike, look, you've got to make this speech. You've got to tear him apart. Your time has come to break this man's, to cut his throat. And Dwight Eisenhower wasn't playing games with Milton. He would say, look, that's not the way to do it. It will only backfire. It will only make, it will only build him up, make him bigger, add to his power, and into the bargain probably draw down upon me as president the fury of the entire United States Senate. Because let me tell you, you attack one senator, it's a club. And no president goes around attacking one member of the Senate without the rest of them coalescing behind him. And they would have coalesced behind an injured member. So I would say, given those limitations, what do you do? How do you bring him down? That's what the problem was, and the book tells how it was done. Okay, now let's ask some questions, if you will.
I would like to ask the first question.
I was associated with the group in New York, right, as the American Bible defending McCarthy, called Aware. Do you know what Roy Cohn founded and Mrs. McCarthy was there?
Yes.
Do you know that group?
Yes, I know about the group. McCarthy's followers are very loyal, and they continue, and Mrs. McCarthy, to her death, was trying to get somebody to write a book, setting. That's right, and Roy Cohn still admires McCarthy, and other people. That is, they're loyalists, and they get together, they meet sometimes. But what more can I say? Yes.
Grab that strategy in a little more detail. Eisenhower's strategy.
Okay, well,
I can read the book, I know.
Okay.
Give me a preview.
Look, I would say that Eisenhower's strategy basically boiled down to three things. The first place, he was determined that he wrote in his diary in April 1, 1953, that the best way to deal with a demagogue of the McCarthy type was not to get into the headlines with him. Counterpunch. Now, Harry S. Truman made the mistake. He counterpunched against McCarthy. Dean Acheson counterpunched against McCarthy. And the counterpunching went on for 3 long years before Eisenhower ever entered the office. And at the end of those 3 years, McCarthy was bigger than ever. And he could make any kind of an outlandish allegation, and the White House or somebody else would respond, and you'd have two columns, McCarthy says this, and the president says that, and you had that battle going on. And Eisenhower recognized that this was page one stuff, it was the kind of thing reporters couldn't resist, and that therefore he wasn't going to contribute to it personally. I mentioned the fact that he did not want to take on the United States Senate. He knew what would happen if he got into this kind of counterpunching. It's an institutional thing with the Senate. That's number one. The second thing that he did was Eisenhower had a funny way of dealing with his organization. He had people he trusted absolutely implicitly. And he would give them a great deal of latitude and freedom to go out and to improvise and to do things that without his immediate control and command. And he had a big organization, and it was a divided organization. The White House staff was split down the middle, some people pro-McCarthy, some people anti-McCarthy. And the same thing with the senators up on the Hill in the Republican Party and the Republican National Committee. You get a great division in the party. But what actually happened as this whole thing unfolded was that you got the nucleus of four men, or possibly call them the Gang of Four, the Gang of Five, who were Eisenhower followers who were determined to deal with the McCarthy problem and who really basically fundamentally were hostile to McCarthy. They were Sherman Adams. Sherman Adams, Eisenhower's chief of staff. Sherman Adams made a decision. He could make a decision in Eisenhower's name. And he spent, believe me, Eisenhower may have spent a lot of time on these other things, but Adams spent a lot of time on McCarthy. The second one was Jim Haggerty, Eisenhower's press secretary. And if you look at the Haggerty diaries, you see the conversations Haggerty had with the president, Haggerty had with Adams and with other people. He was a man in the White House who was part of this organization. Now, across the river in the Pentagon, you had two men who were really trusted by the White House, two and only two. One of them was Struve Hensel, who was General Counsel of the Department of Defense, and Struve Hensel was the man who really took the Army's charges against McCarthy and polished them and got them into shape and kind of masterminded their basic strategy. And the fourth man, and in some respects the most important man of the four, was Fred Seaton, whom I've mentioned. Fred had the job of being he was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for legislative affairs, meaning he had responsibility for keeping the Congress happy. It was half his job. The other half was to keep the press happy. He was press relations man. And Fred, in that role, spent as much time in the White House as he did in the Pentagon, but he went back and forth like a shuttlecock between the two places, and he worked out the whole strategy. He and Adams and Hensel and Hagerty, in effect, became the agents of the president to work through the practical problems. So I would say that that's part number two. The third part is that Eisenhower constantly tried to assert principles that he believed in and that he believed the American people ought to rally around to. People say he never attacked McCarthy. Well, he never attacked McCarthy by name, but if you could read and you knew how to spell and you knew how to watch television, and Eisenhower made a speech in Dartmouth and saying, "Don't join the book burners," you knew whom he was talking about. And when Eisenhower sent his message to the ecumenical group, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, saying it's wrong for McCarthy's incoming chief of staff to attack the Protestant clergy as a nest of Reds, everybody in the United States knew whom Dwight Eisenhower was talking about. And when he got up before and received an award from B'nai B'rith and went on nationwide television and talked about fair play for the conduct of justice, you knew whom he was talking about. He did this repeatedly. And there was no secret about it, except certain people wanted him to get up there and hit Joe McCarthy personally in the nose. That would have made them feel better. Eisenhower saw that as counterproductive. Those, I think, are the three things. When all was said and done, really what happened at the end of the hearings is that the American people saw you've got the decent people on one side, you've got the skullduggery on the other, and when it comes to the anti-communist issue, you've got the decent anti-communists over here, and who were they? Against McCarthy, they were Richard Nixon, finally jumped, became an anti-McCarthyite. Couldn't call him a communist. Herbert Brownell, who was the Attorney General of the United States, the deviser of the Eisenhower Internal Security Program, man who made his speech about Harry Dexter White, he was no communist. And behind him, Bill Rogers, who'd been doing anti-communist things on the Hill before McCarthy ever heard of him. And finally, last but not least, guess who was on Eisenhower's side? J. Edgar Hoover. No question about it. He had to jump. He jumped in the hearings. He jumped against McCarthy for Eisenhower. So what are you going to do if you're an American citizen and you're a good anti-communist? You line up. You have a choice. You can either go with Ike and Nixon and Brownell and Hoover on that side, or you can go with Joe. And the American people in the end said, "The hell with it." He went with Eisenhower. Yes.
Information to Joe McCarthy?
If you read the book, you'll find out. The allegation has gone forward. A good example of historical inference. I don't like Joe McCarthy. I don't like J. Edgar Hoover. Therefore, Hoover was feeding data to McCarthy. Hoover went sour in the 1960s, no question about it, and there were things that were bad and the people apologized for. But if you read, Arthur Schlesinger said, there's only one man who says we didn't get anything from from J. Edgar Hoover. Guess who he is? That's Roy Cohn. Arthur Schlesinger said, everybody knows Roy Cohn's a liar. I can tell you, Ralph de Toledano says they've got stuff from from Hoover, and various historians who are writing, Arthur M. Schlesinger, goes right down the line accusing Hoover on no more evidence than that of, he had no proof whatsoever that Hoover was feeding stuff to McCarthy. After Eisenhower came in, qualified, he may have fed stuff during the Truman years, that I don't know. But say after Eisenhower came in, during the hearings, I thought there was only one way to find out the answer to that question, so I went to the FBI, under the Freedom of Information Act, and I said, you tell me. Give me the documents that tell what J. Edgar Hoover was doing, what his relationship was to the McCarthy subcommittee. And they came back with these documents, and they're incredible. Here are documents, some of them typed, some of them with scrawled handwritings, J. Edgar Hoover's hand. I'll tell you what they boil down to. And if you would lean back and think what you would do if you were J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, Mr. Anti-Communist Subversion, your appropriations depending upon your primacy in this field, your effectiveness, the effectiveness of your networks and your agents, would you throw your best stuff up to this crazy nut on the hill? You wouldn't, and he didn't. He didn't. He gave an order. He said, he saw McCarthy as absolutely, from his point of view and the agency's point of view, as nothing but trouble, trouble, trouble. Now, he played around with McCarthy a lot. He'd go to the racetrack with him. They would have dinner together. They were pals. But underneath, he didn't give him a thing. And it's documented there in any number of internal memoranda written by Hoover and Clyde Tolson and Lewis Nichols and debated among themselves. They were very, very firm on that. He hated the idea that McCarthy would hire ex-FBI agents for his staff. He said, you get enough of these guys, they'll be on the phone, they'll be calling our people, pretty soon our whole network will unravel. It's just not going to work. Hoover did not do it. Yes?
Well, what was the, your view, did television not play a very significant role in the confrontation between Senator McCarthy and Attorney Walsh? Did it come to unravel at that point?
No, I think that was the climax of it. I really do. And when I said that Joe Welch didn't do it, what I said, and you've got to be careful, Joe Welch didn't do it single-handed. In other words, nothing had happened until Welch arrived on the scene, then all of a sudden, boom, he kills him. Welch came at the climax. He was a very significant figure. And what you really had through the hearings, as I pointed out, it was Welch's very brilliant exploitation of a group of accidents that just happened kind of out of the blue, and that in the end had the effect of making McCarthy look worse and less decent and less reliable in the eyes of this huge television-watching public. And they saw McCarthy over here contrasted with Welch, and there's no question that contrast was a central part of the whole thing. I'm just trying to say that it was not the whole thing, that's all. The climactic moment in the destruction of McCarthy came when McCarthy attacked Welch, a young lawyer in Welch's law firm, for having had a communist association a number of years before. And Welch, in that moment, got up and simply went for the jugular. People have never forgotten that, who saw that. And it was a climactic moment. But what I'm saying is that it was part of a big mosaic. Wonderful part, dramatic part. Yes.
The reviewer in yesterday's New York Times didn't exactly buy your thesis, and I wonder how you answer his question, which was if Eisenhower was masterminding this attack on McCarthy, why did he approve the firing of, I think, 1,400 government employees?
Well, he didn't quite say that, but he was almost as mixed up. See, what that particular reviewer did was to say, I said,
I think he's saying, I'm saying that Eisenhower did everything, and he did everything flawlessly. Well, if you had read the book, that's the first disclaimer I make. I'm trying to cut that part out of it, because I don't believe it. He didn't do things flawlessly. Then he said, well, just the fact that Sherman Adams and Jim Haggerty and Fred Seaton and Struve Hensel were working against McCarthy, that doesn't prove Eisenhower was against them. Well, he said, maybe they did it all on their own. Well, for that piece of conclusion, he's got not one scintilla of evidence. In other words, these guys were working for Ike, and Ike knew what they were doing. He would look in on them from time to time. Believe me, if he didn't like what they were doing, he would have called in Sherman Adams and said, Sherm, cease and desist, and Sherman Adams would have done it. They were agents of Eisenhower, no question about that. And the climactic thing, of course, came when Eisenhower decided or gave the order not to let McCarthy go on the excursion into the papers. But the other thing I think shows, again he seems to have felt that he discovered the fact that the United States was worried about anti-communism. I tried to make, I'm blue in the face, I'll show you the passage if you want, but the whole McCarthy movement began with a great public concern over the possibility of domestic subversion in the government. If you go back to the Wheeling speech, which was February 9, 1950, and you look 6 days before that, you know what had happened? Over in England, they found that Klaus Fuchs, a very famous British atomic physicist, who had worked on the atomic bomb in the United States during the war, was a Russian spy. That's 6 days before McCarthy Wheeling. And then if you go back a couple of weeks before that, to January 21, 1950, what do you have? You have Alger Hiss finally convicted, and he's on his way to prison. Now, you can't read of the conviction of Alger Hiss, or you can't read of the exposing of Klaus Fuchs as a man in the street. I don't care what your political persuasion is, whether you're Harry Truman or Dean Acheson or who, and not wonder how many more are in the government. In other words, this seems to be at least the possibility of communist subversion seems to be a significant problem. So everybody in the United States, I would say, as of February 9, 1950, largely, not unanimously, but largely shared that view. That's February 9, 1950. You go to the month when the hearings ended, June of 1954, that's 4.5 years later, a survey is made and people are asked, do you believe that there are communists in the United States government? Or do you believe there are no communists in the United States government? You know how many people said there were no communists in the United States government 4.5 years later, after the end of the Armey-McCarthy hearing? 7%. 7%. That's a tiny fraction. In other words, all I'm saying is that it wasn't a bunch of Republican politicians onto a hot issue about communists in government. It was a broad-based problem. And Eisenhower campaigned in 1952, and Stevenson campaigned in 1952 on a platform, we're going to go down there and we're going to straighten things out. Stevenson had to do it a little bit more gingerly because he was Harry Truman's boy, and Harry Truman was the incumbent. But Eisenhower made no bones about it. We're going to go, the faith of the American people in the integrity of the government and in the loyalty of the government has been undermined, and that is shaking the country up. And until we can get in there and clean up the mess and straighten it out and get the answers in an honest fashion, the country is going to be shook up. And the security program that he set up to get rid of security risks, and they were not just communists, but they were people who were drunks, or people who had a bad criminal record, or people who had all kinds of personal problems, and so on, who could be considered security risks. Eisenhower said we had to come in after 20 years of Roosevelt and Truman and the New Deal and Fair Deal and so on. The new broom is going to sweep clean, and they did. And nobody apologized for that. Brownell ran that program. He devised the program, and he set the framework, and Brownell
Brownell is a civil libertarian as much as anybody else. He's like Earl Warren. And he devised this thing, and they carried it out, and what they did was really, if you will read a column written by Anthony Lewis in like January of 1956, explaining what's happened in Washington under Eisenhower, he said they have come in, they've put in a tough security risk program that has restored the faith of the American people in their government. That's Anthony Lewis. Now, I don't know how else they had a problem. They solved the problem. McCarthy was making that problem. He was just a rogue elephant, a bull elephant. He was out there making things worse, and they wanted to cut themselves loose from him, and they did. That's what happened. So that's a long answer to an allegation in the Star. I really didn't like that review. I don't want to run.
One or two more.
Okay.
McCarthy always had that list in that paper that he waved before the public. Was there a list that he had?
Well, no. There wasn't. He had no list of names. He had no list of names in his hand or anywhere else. The story of the Wheeling speech is a funny story, if it weren't so sad. He went out there, and he really didn't think he was going to do very much of anything in speaking at Wheeling. Didn't think he was going to make any waves. So he thought, might as well get the crowd all riled up. And so he made this a crazy claim. He discovers, he's making a series of Lincoln Day speeches, first one's in Wheeling. He's on his way to Salt Lake City. When he gets to Denver, the plane has to stop for more fuel, and he gets off, and a bunch of reporters descend on him. They say, Joe, where's that list? Where are the names? So he thinks fast. He said, well, fellas, I got the names, I got the list. Unfortunately, they're still on the plane. He's sitting in the airport having a cup of coffee or something. And he says, they're still on the plane, and they're in another suit that's in my my luggage. And I'll tell you what you do. He said, send a wire, make a phone call to President Truman and tell him that if he'll call me when I get to Salt Lake City, I'll give him the names. Well, that's a play for the headlines, all right. And he knew perfectly well Truman wasn't going to pick up the phone and say, Joe, give me the name. And it was this kind of improvisation. Then when he gets to Salt Lake City, well, the first thing that happens, pointed out to Ken, is that somebody took a tape of his original speech, and they played it over Wheeling, West Virginia radio, and after they finished, they said, well, that's all we'll ever need of that tape, and we might as well use it for something else. They took it away and recorded over it. So there is no real record of what he actually uttered, but his figure was in his original script. Well, anyway, when he gets to Salt Lake City, he changes the number, and he changes the number. It goes from 205, and it waffles all over. But basically, he had no list of names high up in the current State Department. He did come up with names of people, familiar names, later on trying to answer his critics. But basically, that original accusation was a barefaced lie.
One final question.
Well, one last. You'll enjoy the book, because all I can say is that, and literally, you talk about the initiative, there were certain things in which Hensel did take the initiative. There were certain things where Hensel and Seton, they were close as that, and Seton would go over and talk to Adams, he'd come back and he'd talk to Hensel. And there were certain things where other people were taking the initiative. The idea that that Hensel was really spending full time on this. There's no question about that. And he and Fred in the Pentagon were really the men on the scene. But Adams called a lot of the shots, and Haggerty called some of the shots. And you've got to, again, I can't single out one guy who all the time is on top. And those four really rolled along, worked their way together.
I think you have some idea why a visitor and friend said that when Billy Ewald left the teaching of English, it was the discipline's great loss. He would have been, still can be, a great teacher, and he's shown that. He does speak well. But I hope he won't be offended if I say that he writes even better. Newcomb Hall and University Hall Bookstore and several others have copies of his book. Some of you may want to read it. It's a little hard to summarize it all, either in text or in response to questions in an hour. It takes a good deal more than an hour. It is the kind of digging in the original documents that some of my bosses say we ought to try to do when we study the presidency at the Miller Center. So partly because he's done my job for me, but partly also because it's an eminently readable book with original documentation and sources that have not been used before. I think if you've enjoyed meeting and listening to Bill Ewald, you'll enjoy even more reading his book. It's been a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.